Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Democratic presidential hopeful Elizabeth Warren called out Facebook last week for its policy permitting politicians to lie. The Warren campaign attracted attention to the policy with its own ad that starts with misinformation. Quote, breaking news, Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook just endorsed Donald Trump for re-election, end quote. Washington Post technology reporter Craig Timberg is covering the issue. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
How long has this Facebook policy been around, and what does it do or not do?
You know, arguably the policy has been around as long as Facebook's been around, in the sense that I don't think Facebook ever made a serious effort to police falsehoods on its platform by politicians or anyone else. What's striking about it now, though, is that Facebook, after the debacle that was the 2016 election, has taken a number of steps to do better, to police it, to crack down on people who were spreading, you know, lies in a coordinated way, as the Russians were on Facebook. But if you're putting up a bunch of falsehoods on Facebook, you may well have consequences for you. But it turns out not if you're a politician. They've expressly carved out political speech as something that's beyond the reach of Facebook's fact checkers.
What are they relying on to justify that?
Their argument is essentially that political speech is unusually protected in the, you know, sort of the American legal and philosophical tradition, and that, you know, politicians should be free to say what they want to about each other without fear that some private company is going to come down and tell them that it's out of bounds. And there's a speech that was given by Nick Clegg, used to be deputy prime minister in Britain and is now the head of global policy for Facebook. Mm-hmm. And he compared it to, like, we just make the tennis court. We draw the lines. We set the net. The politicians, are the ones who are hitting the ball. We don't do that. Of course, you know, in tennis, there's umpires, right? They tell you, they tell you if something's out of bounds. But Facebook says, no, we're not going to be umpires in this.
How much money are they making from political ads in social media in general? It's got to be astronomical at this point.
Yeah, look. Obviously, the Trump campaign in particular is spending many millions of dollars on this, and the Democrats are spending many millions of dollars. I don't have a figure at my fingertips, mm-hmm. but Facebook has always claimed that it's a very small part of their revenue stream, I think less than 1%, which does raise the question of whether it's kind of worth the trouble for them. But when you think about it, like, it's a politically important amount of money, if you will, right? Like, if the president of the United States thinks that Facebook helped to bring him to office, which is true both of Donald Trump and Barack Obama, who used Facebook very effectively in 2008, you know, that's worth something in Washington. That's worth a lot more than whatever dollars come in through the advertising budgets themselves.
There was an ad that the Trump campaign put out about former Vice President Joe Biden and Ukraine, I guess, regarding his son, Hunter. How is that ad treated differently by other platforms compared to Facebook?
I mean, actually, most other platforms also allowed it. I mean, there is CNN blocked it. So CNN's a broadcaster, and it's governed by sort of a different kinds of set of standards, both legally and in terms of its own idea of its ethics in the world. But by and large, Silicon Valley has taken a walk on this question of politicians lying and dishonesty in general. To be kind of more complete about this, they have said many, many times, we do not want to be arbiters of truth. We want to create a place where a free-flowing political conversation and other kinds of conversation happen. And while I do think that they actually believe that, it is of course convenient, right, for businesses to make their money by having us click as often as possible and see as many ads as possible for the conversation to be as unfettered as possible.
It would be expensive to monitor political speech, would it not?
Yeah, but I'm not sure it's that expensive compared to what Facebook is already committed to doing in combating disinformation and falsehood generally, right? I mean, they claim to have tens of thousands of content moderators, unlike in 2016 when they were caught completely off guard by the Russian disinformation. They have a large, sophisticated, and expensive disinformation team, which is true of the other companies as well. I mean, Facebook may actually have the best of these teams. So I don't think it's exactly a resource issue. I think it's in part a kind of ideological and philosophical issue, but also who wants to be the company that tells people who may be the next president of the United States or the next senator or the next congressman that, you know, that your speech is out of line, right? That is a recipe for making enemies. And I think that that's a lot of what they want to avoid.
Well, therein lies this horribly chilling factor of all of this, does it not? I mean, that's the scary part.
I agree with you on this. I mean, I've been covering technology in Washington for, you know, for some years now. And one of the things that that, you know, sort of politically active folks have long pointed out to me is there's actually no incentive for anybody to regulate sort of the, you know, the digital part of politics. It's outside the reach of the Federal Trade Commission, which would deal with a company that misbehaves. The you know, the Elections Commission is never really staffed up on this. Nobody wants to be the entity that tells a politician that they're out of line, because the politicians, once they get to town, you know, control their budgets, control their legal authorities. And in the case of this president, you know, when you cross him, there's a price to be paid. You're going to get tweeted about. You're going to be in some very uncomfortable places. And, you know, our country does not really have a system for checking the behavior of politicians online.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about how Facebook has announced that its policy will be to permit politicians to say whatever they want on that platform. Other social media platforms have reacted basically the same. Facebook obviously is huge. My guest is Craig Timberg. He's a technology reporter for The Washington Post. He's been covering this issue. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Is this, do you see this as a loophole, given that the Trump administration has criticized social media for, you know, punishing pundits for inaccurate information?
Look, it's definitely a loophole in the sense that it's a specific carve out for a certain kind of deceptive political speech, as opposed to you know, it isn't as though all speech is somehow protected on Facebook. It is a carve out when politicians, either through their ads or through their free posts, tell lies. They're saying that's okay, and it's actually a kind of a right on the platform that none of us as ordinary users have. You know, it's worth considering the weird politics of this, right? Like, it's you know, part of what's going on is that, you know, the Democrats feel totally outgunned on social media. And so putting aside whatever happened with the Russians in 2016, which, of course, was very bad in its own right, you know, Donald Trump was an incredibly effective user of social media, Twitter in particular. And a lot of Democrats feel like this tool that in many ways helped them elect Barack Obama has now been turned against them. They're feeling outgunned. Part of what we're seeing is the Democrats kind of lobbying the referees on this. And, of course, Facebook is the most powerful referee in the world now.
Let's see. Iris in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Iris.
Hi. I would like to ask, given that Newsweek reported earlier this week that since July, Zuckerberg has been meeting with, quote, conservative social media influencers, maybe Warren's ad was not so far off the mark. I know that when the internet and technology was newer in the early 2000s, there was a lot of Democratic involvement. Now it seems to be slipping towards the Republican right-wing side. I appreciate hearing from your guest his opinion on this. Thank you, and I'll take my info off the air, okay?
Thanks. Craig Timberg?
Hi, Iris. That's a really good question. I mean, I don't think that Facebook is seeking to endorse Donald Trump, but I do think that they are seeking to inoculate themselves as much as they can from the claim that they're somehow unfair to conservatives or they're suppressing conservative voices and ideas online. You know, that's a big and damaging criticism of them, even if it's not, you know, demonstrably true. You know, Facebook's goal is to be the biggest social media platform in the world, to make, you know, endless billions of dollars. And if half the country or half the world feels like you're not the platform that they want to be on, like that's bad business for them. And so I think you could at this point make the argument, though, that attempting to work so hard to neutralize this accusation that Facebook is somehow hostile to conservatives, that they now are appearing in some ways, not particularly receptive to Democratic complaints. And I think Democrats in Washington and probably around the country are actually really mad at Facebook at this point. They feel like that there's been too much accommodation of the conservative critique and that it's hurting them. It's making it hard for them to win elections.
I think you wrote this, but it refers to Warren's ad as the latest salvo in a growing campaign by Democrats to pressure social media companies to curb the president's ability to push demonstrably untrue information on their platforms. What else is part of that campaign?
Well, just in terms of what's, very public at this point, the Biden campaign complained directly to Facebook about this ad and asked that it be taken down. We are hearing increasingly from Democrats, publicly about how angry they are. We have a debate tonight. It'll be interesting to see if this comes up as part of it. There's just a lot of consternation, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I think we're going to be hearing more and more about this. Of course, Elizabeth Warren has called for Facebook to be broken up, and as well as Amazon and Google, for that matter. Like there is something brewing on the left that is really mad and frustrated at big tech, even more broadly. And you have to wonder how that's going to look if the Democrats claim the White House or other parts of the federal government in 2020.
Let's see. Mike in Columbus, you're on the air with Washington Post's Craig Timberg. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I'm 66 years old, and I can remember when there was a law in the land that said that there was a truth in advertising law. And I can remember politicians going on to a broadcast station, and they would say that, we have to, it's by law, we have to give you both sides of the argument, unless that person refuses to come on there, and then you could only give one side. When did it change, and why did it change, that it went from truth in advertising and you had to show both sides of an issue? What caused that to change to the way it is today?
So the short answer is the law didn't change. The world changed. And so the ability of the to enforce that law is encoded in the federal government's oversight of broadcast stations. Right. So broadcast stations are awarded to individual companies by the FCC, and there are rules that come with it, including public interest rules. The internet is not like that. Facebook's mm-hmm. a private company. Twitter's a private company. Google's a private company. And there really are no rules of the road on the internet about really anything.
Or cable, for that matter, right? I mean,
yeah, or cable, right? Unless you're broadcasting over the public airwaves, there just isn't a regulatory regime in place that insists on really anything in advertising. And this is one part of the argument where I'm actually a little bit sympathetic to Facebook. Like Mark Zuckerberg has been running around saying, we need better laws. We need a kind of a legal system or an ad hoc legal system that would allow us to adjudicate these things more effectively. They're kind of right. Like, why are we expecting private companies whose main business is to serve their customers and make money? Mm-hmm. Why are we expecting them to be the ones who police disinformation and truth squad things? I mean, isn't there a role for our government in addressing these kinds of issues as there was in the past? And for all of the controversy over what happened in 2016, and I've written like 100 or stories about that mess. I mean, we've seen really nothing meaningful out of Congress either. It's been an impressively limp response
on government. So many levels when it comes to the internet. Just one last question. You quoted Katie Harbath. She's the public policy director for Global Elections at Facebook, and a former digital strategist for Republican political committees in a 2008 presidential campaign of Trump's personal lawyer, who we now know, of course, well known as Rudolph Giuliani. And is there a concern? Is that part of the Democrats' frustration, is that they're actually employing people from the political right?
It is. So it's not just Katie Harbath, but also Nick Clegg, who's the former British deputy prime minister, mm-hmm. And a conservative is their head of public affairs and communications globally. The Democrats really have noticed that. I mean, I will say that in Washington, it is kind of standard operating procedure for the lobbying shops and the policy shops of basically every company you can think of to try to balance up their ranks so that they have both prominent Republicans and prominent Democrats. So that, you know, if someone needs to reach out to a congressman who's a Republican from Oklahoma, you send a Republican to do that, right? If someone needs to reach out to, you know, a Democrat from Columbus, you send a Democrat to do that. So that is basic politics in Washington. But with that said, we are hearing that the Democrats feel as though Facebook is kind of tilted in a way that has sort of gone too far, that it's now perceived in some ways as kind of too Republican. And that's a difficult balancing act for any company here.
You know, sometimes I default to Black Mirror episodes because I think that they've done such a great job of, you know,
they're prescient, aren't they?
They really do a great job of encapsulating these kinds of issues. And they did so in one, I can't remember the title of the program, but an actual cartoon character became a candidate.
And
it was all about, hey, we can do this, and it, people love it, and that's all that mattered. And you wonder, all right, well, what is this a slippery slope in our understanding of what politics and who politicians are and what they're able to say? Is it changing, and could it have some kind of profound impact on who we elect?
It's already had a profound impact on who we elect, right?
Yeah.
I mean, social media is the most powerful form of communication, sort of mass communication we have in the world today, right? Not just Facebook. Facebook also owns Instagram. Facebook also owns WhatsApp. So that, like, three of the top five ways people in the world communicate with each other are owned by a single company. And that's before you get to Google, which owns YouTube, or you get to Twitter, which is its own force of nature. I mean, the ways that all of us grew up with and the ways that we communicated, the way politicians communicated with us, they're really not nearly as powerful and important as they once were. And I include sort of traditional news organizations like mine in that as well. I mean, we have a kind of reach that we didn't have back when we had to print all these things and throw them on people's doorstep. And, like, that's great. But, man, a story goes viral on Facebook or on Apple News or whatever, and it just reaches so many people so quickly. And it's almost like we haven't adapted quickly enough culturally to the tricks that people are playing on us, the kind of disinformation that's being peddled. We certainly weren't ready for it in 2016. I don't see a lot of evidence that we're ready for it in 2020.
Craig Timberg, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
It's Craig Timberg. He's a technology reporter for The Washington Post. We've been talking about how Facebook's saying, hey, if it's political speech, we're not going to control it, whether it's a lie. This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
How do you turn what you love into a career? On season 2 of the Rivet podcast from WOSU, hear firsthand from students translating their interests into jobs without college. Listen to This American Graduate Project as we highlight the next generation of workers in the state's top industries of agriculture, insurance, and healthcare. Support for the Rivet podcast series comes from COSI. Subscribe now at wosu.org/rivet, on the WOSU mobile app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Infographics and charts are increasingly familiar online fare. Such illustrations appear easy to understand at first glance, but looks can be deceiving. Alberto Cairo is the Knight Chair in Visual Communication at the University of Miami in Florida. His new book is titled How Charts Lie, Getting Smarter About Visual Information Aims to Help Everyone Get Better at Finding the Truth. Alberto Cairo joins us via Skype. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Anne.
You're a former data and visual journalist. What told you this book needed writing?
Well, I was listening to your interview with Greg Timber right before our conversation.
Right.
I think that he basically laid the ground really well as to why a book like How Chats Lie may be so relevant these days, right? I mean, we are – well, first of all, thank you again for – thank you for having me.
You bet.
It's a pleasure to talk to you today. Anyway, so we live surrounded by visual information, right? I mean, we get to see graphs and charts and infographics and maps in social media and news media these days. And the question that the book poses is whether we are equipped to interpret all these visuals correctly, or whether we pay enough attention to them, right? And my answer to that question is that no, and perhaps that we should. I mean, we should pay the same level of attention to charts that we pay to any sort of content that we see online. So that was my goal.
Give us a classic example of what you mean by how charts can lie. Obviously, it'd be better if we were visual and we could pull a board up, but if you can describe what you mean by that, when considering what we see on social media all the time these days.
Sure. For example, you know, take a look at how the map representing the results of the 2016 presidential election at the county level. Look at the ways that map is being weaponized these days. Just envision that map. Imagine that map in your brain, right? County by county. Red for counties that were won by President Trump in 2016, blue counties that were won by candidate Clinton in the 2016 presidential election. Mm-hmm. Well, if you don't pay attention to that map, and there's nothing with the map itself. What is wrong is our interpretations of mm-hmm. that map, certain interpretations of that map. That map may lead you to believe, for example, and it's the way that is being weaponized by certain sectors of the political spectrum, to basically derive the idea that President Trump won on a landslide. Actually, the other day, I think that it was Laura Trump that tweeted, "Impeach these," over that map, just because that map shows an ocean of red. 80% of that map is red, and little islands of blue here and there. 20% of the surface of the map is covered in blue. So the map is being used to argue that, you know, the Republican Party has much more support than the Democratic Party or candidates, Democratic and Republican candidates. When the goal of that map is not to show popular support. The goal of that map is to show who won where. So you cannot really argue about popular support, just because popular support for the two parties is basically split almost half in half, 50% and 50% mm-hmm. for either of the parties. So that's an example of map that deserves a lot of attention in the way that is being misused to deceive people.
And this is happening more and more and more because visual journalism discovered the online platforms. It's perfect. They are a match made in heaven.
Exactly. Not only the platforms, but it has also been discovered, you know, that people don't pay a lot of attention to the content that they see online, that
right.
we see online, and that we take information that we see online at face value. We tend to sort of trust it automatically, right, and mindlessly. And that is a little bit dangerous. It has always been dangerous, but it's even more dangerous nowadays. We need to cultivate what I would call a culture of attention, to pay attention to what we see and not to mindlessly retweet things that we already agree with, which is a huge danger with all kinds of content, and even more so with visuals, because visuals can be extremely persuasive. They can be very informative. I'm a graphics designer.
Right.
I love visualizations, and I'm a great believer in the power of maps and graphs and charts to inform the public. But as I mentioned in How Chats Lie, the power of visualization will only be realized if on the other side, meaning on the side of the reader is willing to pay a little bit of attention to the visuals that we see every single day.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the use of charts and visual journalism on social media online, which is where a lot of us get our news nowadays. My guest is Alberto Cairo. He's the night chair in visual journalism at the University of Miami and the author of a new book. It's titled How Charts Lie, Getting Smarter About Visual Information. So, Alberto, who is your book for? Is it for everyday people?
It is for everyday people, yes. My previous books were more for graphic designers or data scientists, statisticians. This is the first one that I have written sort of for a general public, just because I believe that graphs and maps can be wonderful. They are wonderful tools to discover how the world works and to explain important information to people. But at the same time, I am alarmed by the ways in which graphs, maps, charts are being misused, and also the ways that they are often misinterpreted, which is also dangerous. So it's sort of a manual on how to become a better reader of charts, a better chart reader. That is what it is about.
You know, when you mentioned you were listening to my conversation with Craig Timberg of The Washington Post about how online social media platforms, they're choosing not to police political speech. And a lot of this is being used in political speech, as you mentioned, you know, county by county, Trump versus Clinton, and how misleading that can be. Are you concerned that the online platforms, the social media platforms, have taken this stance at this point?
I am very concerned. I think that it is wrong, as Facebook likes to argue about itself, that it is not a media company. It is a media company. It is an intermediary. It's a mediator between information and the public. Therefore, it has certain responsibilities that are similar to the responsibilities that a journalist needs to have, which is you need to police the content that appears in your platform. You're not a neutral observer. You are a participant in the public conversation. However, I don't think that Facebook or Twitter or all these platforms will change anytime soon. Mm-hmm. They may change in the future, but in the meantime, while they don't change their policies, it is the public that needs to basically step up their game and, you know, get better at detecting misleading information. Again, cultivating a culture of attention. That's the critical thing. We need to be a little bit more attentive, I think.
Let's talk about how people can do that. What makes a good chart, in your opinion?
Well, that's the core of the book, right? It's like there are certain aspects of a chart that we need to pay attention to whenever we read it. And by chart, I mean graphs, maps, infographics. So first of all, it can take us a long way to detect dubious charts to see what the source of the information is. So whenever you see a chart that doesn't link or doesn't mention the source of the data, the source of the numbers, distrust it outright, immediately, because it's probably that chart is probably hiding something important from you, right? So disclosing the sources, that's the first thing. Second thing is that it can take you a long way to take a look at the primary source of the data, right? Read for 30 seconds. What is it that the chart is actually measuring or showing, right? Mm-hmm. And right after that, you know, reading whether, for example, the data is being distorted, for example, whether the axes of a graph have been cropped in dubious ways, or whether the colors of a map are also distorted or not, you need to make an assessment of that. And then finally, the most important part, I believe, and it's one of the things that I mentioned in the book, that even charts that are correctly designed may still mislead you because you don't pay enough attention to them, or because we all tend to project what we already believe onto the charts that we see every day. So we need to police ourselves a little bit. We need to police our own ideological and biases, for example, right? Am I reading too much into the chart that is in front of my eyes right now? Am I projecting onto this chart what I already want to believe? We call this the confirmation bias, right? We should all learn a little bit more about how to police these biases.
I don't want to hurt your feelings, but particularly since I see so much news online now, I tend to not look at the charts at all. I read the content.
Well, that's perfectly fair. If you feel more comfortable with just reading written words, that's perfectly fine. But you are missing out. I mean, sometimes information cannot be correctly explained if it is not through a visual. And visualizations can be very powerful, very useful. And in the book, I try to show sort of the dark side of visualization. But I also try to cast attention onto the positive side of charts, how powerful they can be, how useful they can be.
Give me an example of a good, solid illustration that works for you and that people can trust.
Well, I mean, yeah, that people can trust in general. I would not mention specific types of charts, but specific sources of charts. And this is something that I discuss in the book itself, how to develop a proper media diet, right? How to develop a sense of what media sources are more trustworthy or less trustworthy. And there are several strategies that we can follow for that. But, you know, NPR online, it's a great source of great charts. NPR has a great visuals team that produces excellent charts on a regular basis. ProPublica, an investigative reporting organization based in New York. And then, you know, usual suspects such as the New York Times or the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, they regularly produce excellent visualizations and excellent data reporting on a regular basis.
Are you concerned about people or entities taking charts that start out fine, they're done? It could be done by the Washington Post. It could be something you designed. Can they monkey with that kind of stuff now? Can they amend it and change it?
They can amend it. And not only that, I mean, a chart can be interpreted in multiple ways. And again, going back to the example of the county level 2016 results, election results map, there is nothing wrong with the map per se. What it is wrong is the way that it is misinterpreted and the ways that it is misused. And that's always always a danger, even if it doesn't involve active manipulation of the map itself. The manipulation is in the interpretation. There is always a danger in that. But, you know, if the public is better prepared to deal with these misinterpretations, it will not really matter that bad actors will distort maps or misinterpret maps, because we will be prepared to basically fight against that as readers.
Alberto Cairo, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Alberto Cairo is the Knight Chair in Visual Journalism at the University of Miami in Florida, and he's the author of the book, How Charts Lie, Getting Smarter About Visual Information. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The online video game Fortnite destroyed itself this weekend. Within the world of the game, a black hole sucked up everything, leaving players anticipating a new chapter. Android Central contributing editor Russell Holley is following the excitement. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
All right, so what happened?
It's probably the weirdest thing any video game has ever done. People logged in to play this game over the weekend, and they watched as their character on the loading screen of the game got sucked into a black hole and then just disappeared. Like, the game wasn't available to play for two straight days. And that was it. There was nothing else to see or do. There were no other buttons to press. The game just did not exist for 48 hours. And there was a live stream on both YouTube and Twitch from the official Fortnite accounts that was just a black screen. In this amazing marketing stunt, there were hundreds of thousands of people watching a blank screen for two straight days in the hopes that the people from Fortnite would tell them something about this new part of the game that's coming up. And they just didn't. They just let them watch a black screen for two straight days.
So it wasn't a marketing stunt. There was no prior warning.
There was some stuff in game where it looked like parts of the large game map were under attack by some kind of force. It turned out that was in fact the black hole.
Uh-huh.
And the entire goal here was to draw this massive global bit of attention for what is now being called Fortnite Chapter 2, which is a brand new take on the game.
What if people were in the middle of something they were really into? I mean,
they don't get a vote. Epic Games has done versions of this for several different releases across the Fortnite game, where everyone is playing online at the same time. This is hundreds of people are playing against one another, and so when something happens in the game world, it happens to everyone, and that's been a big part of the way that this game has functioned. It's one of the reasons why it's so popular, because it encourages you to check in every day to see if something has happened to the world that you've been playing in.
Is this the first time something like this has happened on an online video game?
It's definitely the first time that something has happened on this scale, and it's something that drew this much attention. And curiously, this is something that happened beyond kind of the game world. Most games that have an online component, you get to like a login screen and you select your character, and then it puts you in this game world with a bunch of other people. This was the first time that I can remember that something like this happened as soon as you started the game. Like, you saw your character, and then your character just kind of disappeared. It wasn't actually clear if your character had been deleted or not for a little while.
So what do we know? I mean, Fortnite create, Fortnite taketh away. What is it giving back now?
Yeah, so Chapter 2 is a new map with a whole lot of new game challenges and new experiences to kind of run around and explore. And that's exactly what people are doing in seemingly record numbers. There are people who are jumping on to play this new version of Fortnite to see everything that has changed. It doesn't seem like the actual gameplay, the concept of playing one versus 99 other people, has changed appreciably. It doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of changes in like the weapons or the characters or the visuals or anything. It was just a really great way to get a whole bunch of people's attention all at once.
How many people did this affect?
Millions of people across the world. Fortnite is by far one of the largest games on the planet right now, and it started Friday, where it started getting people's attention, and by yesterday morning, there were millions of people who could not access the game at all.
I'm wondering, I mean, so they threw away something that millions of people were playing religiously for something else. Do you have a sense about what the strategy was there? Why throw the baby out with the bathwater?
I think it takes a remarkable amount of not only confidence but also awareness of your audience.
Yeah.
To do something like this. The people at Epic were aware that a lot of their audience just really appreciates new things being introduced into the game, and so they just decided to replace everything for a little while and see how that worked. And I think it was tremendously successful.
And you said replace everything for a little while. Chapter 2 is the next world now, right? It's not like they're going to go back to Chapter 1.
Right. The things that were removed from Fortnite are unlikely to come back. Epic hasn't made any official statements on it. But the new set of challenges, it's unlikely that they're going to roll back to the original design.
Did you get your own character back at least?
Yes. Anybody who had a character in the game, all of that stuff is still there.
Okay. All right. Well, there's a little bit of continuity, I suppose.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Google is expected to announce a new phone, the Pixel 4. What's it going to look like?
It actually just happened. Their announcement wrapped up about 20 minutes ago.
Oh, okay.
And it is it looks very similar to other Pixel phones in very much the same design as a Samsung phone or an iPhone. Google has, a design language that has a kind of unique look to it, where it's got this kind of boxy rectangle that has bright colors on the back. This time, the one big bright color that you can buy is kind of an iridescent orange, which is kind of Google's big thing, is to have a white version and a black version, and then a single very colorful version that you can buy. The big features for this phone are actually the things that happen on the front, though. Google has removed the fingerprint sensor for a phase unlock system that is not appreciably different from the way that Apple's works. And we actually talked about this a bit last week with some of the problems they had or some of the controversy found in creating that system.
Mm-hmm.
But what we also now know is that the way that technology works is actually a little different from the way that Apple's works, in that it functions even when you are not using the phone. You can actually it uses this technology that Google calls Soli to be aware of where you are in the room. So if you go to reach out for the phone, it actually detects that your hand is nearby before you've touched it and wakes up the screen to let you know that it's aware that you're nearby. It knows when you're looking directly at it, and it's aware of how long you've been away, to do things like turn off the always-on display, so that it knows that if you haven't actually been nearby a little while, it doesn't actually have to spend that power to keep the display on.
I don't know. Why am I creeped out by all of this?
Well, for two reasons. One, because it's Google, and two, because it involves the idea of something being aware of where you are in a room without really a whole lot of interaction on your part. This has kind of been the Google model for a little while now, is that it announces something and everyone goes, man, that seems kind of weird. I don't know if I like that. And then they use it and they go, man, I need this in my life. I don't understand why everything doesn't work this way.
Well, how do they know it's me and not my spouse?
So it's a two-part system. The ability to wake up the phone is different from the ability to unlock the phone.
Okay.
And so unlocking the phone is what requires, you know, kind of the face unlock technology. But just being aware of someone in the room, that
okay.
actually does not know the difference between you and your spouse.
Okay. How do those features work? I mean, what's Google doing? Are they listening? Are they feeling?
Yeah, so this technology called Soli, S-O-L-I,
yeah.
is a custom chip that Google's been working on for actually 6 or 7 years now, and it's a radar-based presence system. So it uses this kind of low-power frequency system to detect when you are nearby. And when it knows that something is in that proximity, then it can use certain behaviors based on that. But it's a low-power way of doing things that we used to spend a lot of power doing with cameras.
Mm-hmm.
To accomplish the same goal, but you know, having a camera on a phone is you know really expensive from a battery perspective. So this technology allows it to you know to function without consuming nearly as much power as you know previous systems that tried to do the same thing.
They also have Pixel Go. What's that?
So the Pixel Book Go is a new take on Google's Chromebook line. This is a laptop style Chromebook. That offers Google's Chrome OS instead of Windows or OS 10. I'm sorry, Mac OS. And it's just a continuation of what Google has been doing. This is a laptop that doesn't run the operating system that you know a lot of people are particularly used to unless you have been in school over the last 10 years. Google's made tremendous steps in the classroom with its Chromebook line, and the hope here is the same that we've seen from Dell and HP, in that these are laptop-style computers that are, you know, not the kind of tablet design that we've seen over the last year or two, so that when people are leaving high school or considering entering college, they can have the operating system that they had as they were going through their primary school.
They're banking on that investment they made coming back to them. Right? I mean, the investment in schools that Google has made.
Right. This is a reflection of that investment entirely. The entire roadmap for Chrome OS, it is reasonably successful outside of the classroom, but the
uh-huh.
amount of Chromebooks that you see in a classroom just defeats Google or Microsoft and Apple by orders of magnitude in most places.
Any changes to Google Home and Mini?
We're definitely going to see a new Nest Mini that's going to be available this week, and the goal there is to make another inexpensive, you know, kind of voice system similar to the Echo Dot is available in every room in the house, basically. So you can put as many of them in the house as necessary, and use your voice to wake them up and give commands, and have a much better speaker than the previous version had.
Okay.
So that you can use it to stream music. In multiple rooms in the house.
Is that the same thing as I'm seeing here referred to as Nest Wi-Fi?
No, Nest Wi-Fi is actually a take on what was originally called Google Wi-Fi, because we're moving everything under the Nest brand now for reasons that I still don't fully understand, but, you know, I don't work for Google, so. This is a mesh network system. So if you have a house that has kind of a complicated Wi-Fi system, you are in one room and the Wi-Fi doesn't work quite as strong as it does in the other room, this is designed to be a solution for that, so that you can actually place multiple pedestals in different rooms in your house, and the software kind of intelligently figures out how to balance that signal strength so that you have the same kind of connection throughout your home.
Launching it, obviously, so you have better connection to Google, right?
Well, you know, it's definitely just a better connection to the internet in general. But yes, I'm sure Google would prefer that you use as many of its services as it offers.
Any other expected announcements while you're there?
No, I think, you know, we're going to see an update to what's called the Pixel Buds line, which is the set of earbuds that were announced almost as a prototype a couple years ago that did live voice translation, which was really fascinating. You could have the Pixel Buds in, and you could hand your phone to someone, and the two of you could speak entirely different languages and hear the translation in real time through the speaker and the headphones. There's supposed to be an updated version of that focuses a little more on audio quality and not quite as much on the real-time translation, pitching them more as a nice set of headphones that follow the Pixel line, similar to what you would see with Apple's AirPods.
Hmm. Disney Plus, it's Disney's anticipated streaming service, announced its lineup. What does it look like?
It is hundreds and thousands of things. The Disney Plus Twitter account started yesterday, just kind of rapid fire announcing every single thing that was going to be in its lineup on launch day, and it was hundreds of tweets announcing all of the things that were available. And we knew that a lot of this was happening. At the D20 announcement from earlier this year, where there's going to be a ton of original TV shows and a lot of stuff from Disney's prior catalog was also going to be available. Now we also know that almost the entirety of Disney's classic movie catalog is going to be available, and a lot of older TV shows that were part of Disney Channel and some of the younger focused channels that aren't quite as popular anymore are all going to be a part of this network. It is just millions of hours of Disney content that's all going to be available on launch day. And it's a staggering thing to look at the list, honestly.
Is it all just for kids?
No, not at all. Some of this goes, very far back into Disney's catalog for adult content, or rather, teen-focused content, young adult content, and then, some of the older movies that were back before Disney did everything with digital animation.
What do you think how it's going to stack up against Netflix and Hulu?
So the interesting thing here is it actually doesn't matter how it competes with Hulu, because Hulu is owned by Disney.
And okay,
Disney's
that's right. Yeah,
bundling Hulu with Disney Plus in some cases. So the cool thing there is that's kind of Disney's way of getting you to also pick up like a sports channel or something if you go and do that as well. But Netflix, I'm surprised at how unconcerned Netflix seems right now with the amount of content that's available here, because the way that things are priced right now, there are going to be a lot of people that are going to choose between Disney Plus and Netflix, and not nearly as many people who are going to try and do both. And it's going to be really interesting over the next year to see how much is done from both of these services to keep people choosing one or the other.
How is it priced? I mean, what are we talking about?
Yeah, so you're still under that $10 a month, for either of these services, for kind of the basic version of the service. And Netflix has higher tiers if you want high definition streaming, or if you want a whole bunch of different televisions to be able to stream at the same time. There are options that are available there. And Disney Plus is going to offer some pretty competitive pricing there on purpose. I think the goal definitely is to offer this $8 a month service in order to get people to see that it's only a dollar or two cheaper than Netflix, but that's going to end up being enough for some people.
One of the things Netflix does is original content.
They do a lot of original content, but it's also incredibly expensive. And that's something that over the last year or two has actually made shareholders and Netflix kind of uncomfortable, because there's just been this tremendous spend in new shows. And then sometimes they don't last super long. We take a look at some of the Marvel Cinematic Universe shows that spun up. They only lasted two or three seasons and then they were canceled. And some of this goes back to Netflix's, kind of algorithm for new content. When the stuff that people are watching starts to, to be less kind of explosively popular, they just kind of scrap it and move on. And that causes a lot of people who really enjoy watching TV shows for a long haul to question whether they should start watching something new with Netflix to begin with.
Only to have their heart broken.
Right.
Not saying anything, talking about myself or anything right now, but the Girl Scouts, we have a few more minutes left. The Girl Scouts has a STEM badge now, and Microsoft partnered with them to offer free workshops. What are they learning in them?
This is super cool. There's actually going to be a total of 5 badges that are going to be available, I think, by the beginning of March. That are going to be available through the Girl Scouts. These 5 new badges start with basics in computer sciences. There are 2 robotics courses and then a cinematography and photography badges. And Microsoft is actually lending technology to help with all of these, which is really fascinating. It's not clear, how Microsoft is going to be involved in kind of individual, like troop-to-troop, planning for any of this stuff. But it seems like what Microsoft is doing is actually working with the Girl Scouts directly to create some of the structured plans for each one of these, not necessarily courses, but each one of these programs to earn these merit badges.
Out of the goodness of their heart, they're doing this?
Well, I mean, Netflix, Microsoft has definitely had a lot of practice when it comes to STEM research in children, and they understand that being able to encourage young people, in particularly women, to join the sciences has been really important. And so I think that this is, getting any child interested in you know, science and technology and mathematics at an early age is super important. But, you know, there's clearly fewer women joining these industries to begin with. And while some of that stems from a genuinely toxic environment in some cases, mm-hmm. education at an early age is something, you know, worth addressing as well.
Russell Holley, thanks so much for your time today. As usual, really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
It's Russell Holley, contributing editor for Android Central, a regular on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. That's it today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.